Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The VN Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
K-Man Candy.
Man of Doom.
You threw a car at my head.
Right, the ransom 16 by bars.
Yeah. I think getting that achievement requires counterintuitive patience.
Pretty much. This is episode 128, here with regular co-host Dan Q.
Wake me up when September ends.
We're hoping Mackie will join us later. Philip?
If you were going to listen to one thing today, make it college football. But if you're listening to two things, listen to us, Polycast.
Kelly?
Hi.
And myself, Man of Doom. I can't remember why I'm doing this, but let's go.
In the past few weeks, I did try my hand at a couple of games of competitive multiplayer. Right from Civ 5 with complete strangers. I mean, maybe I've talked to them on the forums using a different handle in the past. I did it very much. My second game was just a duel game, which I won, but my first game was with five other human players on a small Pangea map, and I was the first to die around turn 100. But it was nice that all of the players that I played with, there was absolutely no trash talk, at least in the public. I mean, they could have been trash talking to each other, I'm assuming not, though. I just wanted to give them props for that. Anime DRZ, Bath, Beach, Debo, Human Fu, and Doughead. Specifically to DDO, he was England. Well done. I hate you all. And
hey, you too, Dan.
No,
I've played a fair bit of online. I've noticed almost about 95% of the matches, there will be no trash talk that is over the top, and most of the time there isn't any. It's just all friendly, which is very comforting because a lot of online games are noobs, go die, and yeah.
Your mom.
Yeah, fill in the blank.
I think we're going to get right into forum talk here. This is a thread started by Pop Psyche. I think that's how you pronounce it. I apologize if I butcher that. But anyway, the thread is titled, "When Should I Stop City Growing?" And the opening post is short, so I'll read it all out. When should I use this option in the city management? What is the advantages and disadvantages? All right, so well, basically, post number 2 on this thread sums it up quite nicely in that you should probably never use it. But this topic still has a lot of, this thread still has a lot of useful information in it going down when it comes to city management. Basically, the incentive to stop growing is because you're either capped by happiness or health issues in Civilization 4. Now, obviously, happiness issues, you'll grow, but your pop won't do anything, so it just costs maintenance and does nothing. Whereas health, you lose an extra food per turn for each pop that you're over, the health flat cap. Both of these are bad things, unhappiness being worse. But the more viable alternatives to avoid growth, which is almost never, there's some really, really fine micro points. Like when you're trying to store food for the granary before you complete it, for example, that you might want to avoid growth, but GHP stage is probably never will work for you up into, and it probably including deity, so there you go. Your alternatives, you have a few. One is to just grow into unhappiness and whip. That's the most common one. That allows you to continue working your best tiles and converting food to hammers, such as like a 6-year-old corn tile or 6-year-old pig tile, maybe with some iron. And then you can get more production out of your city than you could if you stopped growth and took your people off those super productive tiles. Alternatively, if you have specialist slots, you can run specialist slots. That can also be very useful when your whip banger's cooling. And then the final thing is just to pick tech choices so that you can manage your growth cap early in the game. Most good players will try to get multiple cities into the double digits of population in the BCs, Really, you're looking more at pop working quality tiles necessarily than cities in a lot of cases on the higher difficulties because of maintenance costs and difficulty getting to sites before the computer. And it's similar in multiplayer in that you don't want to overextend your abilities to defend yourself. So you're going to want to look for monarchy if you're running a lot of cottages, possibly drama if you're running a lot of specialists. And that's about it. You're limited in options early in the game.
Yeah, I would say I'm one of those that the first one that you mentioned there, Phil, which is, you know, letting the city grow and then whipping. I will then combine that with also, as you said, for instance, going towards monarchy so you can adopt the hereditary rule civic and you get +1 happy for military units stationed in your city. And also going for other technologies that will allow you to build buildings or maybe even in some cases first that will give you some abilities for additional great person points or just the ability to make a citizen instead of working a tile for it to actually become a great scientist, for example, like putting a library in your city so you can get a couple and you can rush towards that first great scientist that you can then choose to help with your further expansion, such as, okay, let's get the great scientist, let's bulb mathematics while I'm continuing to research towards, say, what's the tech that I need for courthouses again?
Code of laws.
Code of laws, thank you.
And come on now, don't be bolding mathematics unless you're trying to get something fancy from the Oracle. It's not good value. So many wasted beakers.
No, I'm doing that. So then currency is next to increase my trade risks while I'm researching towards.
Even so, it's so useful. And I was reading through some of the Succession game threads, and they were talking about it, and one of the D&D players just getting pissy because they wanted to bold math. But they were doing it to Oracle something. This is one of the previous ones, so I'm not causing any grief. Anyway, mathematics, the thing about a great scientist is it can bolt upwards of thousands of, well, not thousands, but over 1,000 beakers. And something like mathematics is only worth like 400, 500, something in that range beakers. This is normal speed beakers. So you're throwing away a lot of potential beakers there. Whereas, like, say you're running binary research, you throw the academy in your capital, you'll get probably more over the course of the game with your early great scientists doing that than almost anything else, unless you're just doing a massive rush strategy, in which case you might want to settle. Either settling or an academy are better than bolding math, though. Probably the first big thing you should be bolding if you're not trying for like a really super early oracle of a powerful technology is something like philosophy, maybe machinery or engineering under specific strategies.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but at the same time, I guess it's I'm often in either a very quick expansion, and that's either expansion because I'm settling cities because there isn't an AI near me, or I've taken out an AI. And yes, I want the code of laws for courthouses to help with the maintenance issues, but I could also benefit from having not only currency. I guess that's also not the only thing I'm going for. But in addition to currency aftermath, that also gives me the line towards construction for catapults, which I may in fact need to finish off the war or to now be able to better defend myself because perhaps I've overextended myself a little bit because now, oh, I took out this civ. That was relatively painless military-wise, but now I'm bumping borders. Ooh, alliteration. I'm bumping borders with an even more powerful civ.
It's all well and good, but still, it's the mathematics bulb is so poor just because you don't get enough beakers for it. Take your settled great scientist. This is probably the weakest alternative, but just by comparison's sake, if you have a library in your capital, which you probably would if you farmed a great scientist, you're getting 7.5 beakers and a hammer per turn. It's only going to take like 100 turns of that to beat out mathematics, roughly. Actually, no, it takes less. And the BC era only is like 115 turns. Literally, you're almost getting a better return from settling it during the relevant time frame of your rush. And in fact, you probably are. Not to mention that you do get a hammer there in addition to the beaker value. And you could really compare something like a settled great scientist to working a gem mine. It's that good. The math bulb, unless you're doing something very specific, the math bulb just isn't strong enough to merit it as your first great scientist usage. Although we are getting a little away from the topic of city growth, I suppose. Other than that, you could try to farm great scientists if you're worried about growing into unhappiness.
Well, we were getting back around to how it tied into the original topic. You just did.
There you go, there you go.
We're just working on that meta level that requires...
yeah, you're oracling currency or construction or civil service, or I wouldn't bolt math early on. If you can oracle civil service, that is tremendous. Hard to pull off on higher levels, but very powerful. Very early bureaucracy.
You can make the same argument that you're making there, Phil, for the lower difficulty levels, but perhaps I'm not suffering as much as it were seeing as how I typically play on Monarch. And actually, if I've interpreted your counter argument correctly, the fact that I play on quick speed as opposed to normal might actually amplify your argument. But in any event, take it for what you will.
Yeah. It's all about the early growth curve and what your early investments are going into in terms of attacking quickly. And that's actually true for Civ 5 as well as 4. Anytime you're investing your in-game resources a certain way, you're looking to get the highest return within the framework of your strategy. So, you know, you're either trying to get the most units out possible for a rush, or you're trying to get the X, Y, or Z tech the fastest, whatever it is. I'm not quite at the level of some of the deity players, but I've been working on my Civ 4 micro as of late to try to get my times faster. But a lot of these guys, even with no tech trades, can pull liberalism in the early ADs. And a lot of that has to do with how well they manage their great scientists, how well they prioritize working certain tiles in the early game, tech choices. And certainly you can get away with not doing that on lower difficulties, or even up to like Monarch, Emperor, and Immortal. You can get away with doing much less efficient processes. But I would argue that getting 200 AD liberalism is pretty useful in any difficulty.
Now moving into Civilization 5, specifically a colonization system for Civ 5, a thread started by Ricey, R-I, oh wow, I can't read, R-Y-C-double-I, there we go. You can use a settler to found a colony instead of a city. The colony works like a fully allied city-state, which gives you work resources and a bonus. Influence with the colony starts at a top level and begins to decrease like a normal city-state. You have to finance your colony like a city-state to maintain the influence at a positive value, and you are the only one that can influence this colony city-state, quote-unquote. He then goes on to list three different status values, loyal, controlled, independent, which is similar to CS's allied, friends, and neutral. But in this case, he notes that when the colony's influence goes under 30, so that's influence to you, and of course only you, based on his mechanic, that only you can influence the colony city-state. But if it goes under 30, then it declares independence and becomes a normal CS like others, and other civs can now influence or protect them. And then he also argues why found colonies instead of cities, or indeed as an aside, what would the difference be? From these, as say, puppet cities. He says, because they are not cities, they don't affect happiness or culture influence. Because if you finance them, they give you some kind of bonus every turn. And because you don't have to found a city in a far and or bad place, only to get a resource that you do not have. Before I go into some of the specifics of his suggestion here, I'm going to say that I like the idea of bringing colonies back. I do not like this suggestion in and of itself because I think we already kind of have that in a way in terms of existing city-states and also substantially in the form of puppet cities. I really don't see why I would want to found a city-state as opposed to either just founding a city myself or taking a city or taking a city-state to a lesser extent.
I can think of a couple reasons, and they all involve tremendous abuse. I love it. I love thinking of ways to cheese the puzzle systems the instant I see a suggestion. No, but think of it this way. You spawn, like, say, 15 colonies on a decent-sized map. You just spam colonies as a priority, while otherwise going mostly vertical. And then you go patronage, and you pick up the social policy that gives you some research for all the research of your city states, if these guys would count towards that. And you pick up the one that you can randomly get great people from them. And then you go for a diplomatic win, just as an example. And if these things count for their own for diplomatic win, that would be really difficult to break. And unless the AI was on the ball killing them, but when does that ever happen?
Okay, let me clarify. Why would I want to see this introduced as suggested in terms of balance? You're right, because it is so open to abuse, and I guess I already filtered in my mind how this would be open to abuse. And, I mean, I like abuse when it's in my favor, but I'm thinking, yeah, let's not have, especially if maybe I can't do it in turn, like, especially this, like, you were the only one that can influence the colony city-state. Like, if you don't drop it below 30 at any point, then no other civ, so either an AI or maybe in multiplayer, no multiplayer, none of your human competitors can try to influence it either. Like, oh my gosh, really?
Humans would just kill it. Or kill you, because you're putting resources into it. But the AI probably couldn't handle these kinds of things. And it would I have concerns of what it would do to diplomacy, because you get this warmongering menace stuff, and every time the AI wiped out one, it would probably count as a civ. And all of a sudden, you know, somebody kills two of those things, they're the most hated guy in the world, even if you threw them in their AI's face.
I think it was suggested later in the thread that if you were in turn yourself to take out, so like if you were to go and capture like your own, then you, although I don't know why you would necessarily do that, that you would not suffer that warmongering menace influence.
Why?
I don't know why.
I'd rather see them like you would plant a puppet city. And you could do the influence system normal. It'd be just like basically instead of conquering a puppet city, you just plant it. It'd be good for cultural victories because they give them a way to produce more gold. But at the same time,
and
I
more
could
gold,
think,
sure, honestly,
puppet cities don't hardly produce any. You maybe get the monument.
No, I guess you're right. You're right.
And then secondly, they would be not like in this. They would definitely affect your happiness because you planted them. And based on the influence in them, they would produce more or less unhappiness towards your empire. So if you fail to fund your colonies, you could be in a happiness hell.
Yeah, he tries to draw parallels between these colonies and the city-state and working in with the city-state mechanic. Like someone suggested last year in the context of reintroducing religion to Civ and having that like be a religious city-state. But here, rather than coming up with another means for a city-state, another type of city-state, talking about using the city-state mechanic to incorporate something which isn't really exactly a city-state. It's not certain that, you know, that how I would influence it. I mean, he suggested that, you know, you're getting a resource and a resource bonus, for instance, and then the happiness bonus similar to a city-state, and that each type of city-state, you know, would aligned to like a military or a culture or a maritime in terms of the bonus that it's giving you. Or even suggested have it be a new type of city state where you're getting a mixed bonus, like you're getting X culture, X food, X gold, X science. And that one in particular, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, open to abuse. Why would we ever do much of anything with quote unquote normal city states if we could have colonies using the city state mechanism as he has suggested?
Yeah.
There's actually a related thread, and none of my guests know about this thread. I only came across this actually this morning, and I know, Phil, you responded to it because that thread actually had to do with vassals and colonies. Vassals, oh, let's not even go there. But as far as we want the show to end sometime this century. Plus
one to rage.
I never thought I would actually say this. Would like to see perhaps something that we had in Civilization 3. Deep breath.
Wait. No. We don't like Civ 3 things around here, don't you know?
Wait, the defensive pack mechanic. There you go. That's something that should have made it from Civ 3 on. Because in Civ 3, when you signed a defensive pact, the AI actually reevaluated your power rating with the new AIs that you signed the defensive pact with. And it doesn't do that in 4. Does it do it in 5? I don't think anyone's confirmed that I've seen.
Defensive pacts aren't public. In 5, defensive pacts aren't public, so you don't know who their true allies are.
That doesn't mean
the
AI doesn't cheat to determine it, though. But, yeah, okay.
I would like to see colonies as it was done in Civilization 3. Now, in Civilization 3, you needed to build a road to that resource. Okay, so we're going to set that aside like resources are already in Civ 5. Where a colony is thought of as a pop one city, if anyone walked into it, as it was described on Civ Fanatics Info Center, quote, it just folds like a cheap unit and is essentially lost. So there isn't like a situation where a colony is captured, for example. So if you don't want to settle a city, but you want that resource, it's a little farther flung. So you go, you settle that colony, but that colony is only ever that particular resource. If you want to defend that, then you're going to want a unit in there. And unlike previous civs, there can only be one unit actually on the resource because of the one unit per tile. But if you really wanted to protect it, then you could give yourself a little carpet of doom around there to protect it. I think that would work better. And then if for some reason, if you decide to settle a city later and or your culture just happens to extend to there, then the colony isn't of itself disbanded because it's no longer required. I think that would be better than trying to do some kind of merging with the city-state mechanic.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Now, you would need to look at some of the ease that would allow you to require resources in the early goings, but that would be an interesting dynamic for Civ 5, and certainly not nearly so broken as the original suggestion here. When I read that, I can't think of what to do. Would be how you would tweak that mechanic within the framework of the game so that it isn't just disgusting in terms of the ways you could take abuse of it, especially in single player.
And it wouldn't be like we tried to do with colonies in Beyond the Sword for Civilization 4 either. With the separate continents and here.
They really made the incentive to do that, the maintenance, though, which you don't pay any distance maintenance in Civ 5 whatsoever. It's all about your happiness maintenance and whether or not you can defend the city instead.
I mean, I'm certain we could also try to come up with an entirely new mechanic, something that hasn't been tried before, but the Civ 3 one, Civ was tried before. I thought that was, I actually do kind of miss those colonies from Civ 3. Not enough to go back and play Civ 3, but...
yeah.
I'm still stuck on you saying, but I like abuse.
Yeah, that's definitely needed to be
taken. You know, he's a teacher. He gets abuse all the time from his students. I'm thinking this is why he goes back.
No, we got to take this out of context and make him look really bad somehow.
Yeah. It all goes with the territory.
Well, what?
See, because, you know, we're talking about getting territory with resources.
No, we get it.
No, sorry.
See? I know I had to explain.
Fail, man. Pun fail.
I don't have one of those drum roll things to do, unfortunately. I need to be able to insert sound bites. Yeah.
Let's see, some related things in the thread that we really haven't talked about. Someone suggested a possible new unit, a colony or a colonist that's a little more expensive than a settler, can only be built in coastal cities and cannot be used on the same continent. I'm going to stop you right there. A possible new unit? No, thank you. In Civ 3, if you wanted to found a colony, you had to expend a worker as opposed to building a settler.
Yeah, how about you build a fort on it?
Just a thought.
Sounds familiar somehow. Where have I heard this before?
My favorite question in the entire thread, which kind of came a little bit after discussing the base suggestion, still staying on the base suggestion, which was, now let's talk about multi-colonial situations. If you found more than one colony, what do you propose? And I think you kind of already actually addressed it at the beginning, Phil, which is towards making a diplomatic victory that much sweeter.
I don't think your own colony should be able to vote for you.
Well, yeah, then you put them on the same pedestal as it.
I don't either.
And you're equating them to a city-state, which is a separate
entity.
It's like your own cities are so close to being colonies functionally themselves. I don't know. I mean, you have a happiness hit for it. But if you do have the resources, you can generally mitigate the majority of the happiness penalty in settling for a resource. And if you're settling for multiple resources or a luxury, too, you're not even that behind in that regard. I just don't see the benefit of this mechanic over others proposed, I guess, or fixing current ones.
So maybe in summary, in this case, Civ 3 wins. Oh, dear. Wow. Well, just like the random number generator, you know, when it says you're almost certainly going to win, and then you lose. Well, this is why Civ 3 works in this case, because it was 0.1% chance that
something.
Our next topic, which hopefully Mackie will kindly introduce.
Another memes. Wait, have it here somewhere. Sorry, I have too many tabs open. You should see this. I have a whole separate window for all of our topics. It's ridiculous. Let's talk about how crazy my other
open them one at a time.
All right, another memes. Oh, it's Dan's thread. Oh, I see why we have thread now.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I had a bit of an eyebrow raise when I saw it on our preview, because I've been in this thread already, so go for it, Mackie.
So Fanatics Dan, of all people, started a thread about another means to war without the warmonger diplomatic penalty.
How do you pronounce that name again? Is it Dank?
Dank? Dank what?
Dank.
Dank. Dank. That's right, Dank, over there.
Dank.
I think since it's Dan's thread, he can take it away from here, because good God, you wrote a lot of stuff. I can't summary this.
Fine. It really did. Yeah, I'm not going to read the whole thing, because I was trying to explain, as well as give a little bit of background about where the heck this thread even came from. But essentially boils down to, how do we completely destroy, or at least deal a final blow to a civilization without getting the warmongering diplomatic penalty?
Let the other AIs do it.
Yes, we discussed this in some context on our 126th episode, and even since that episode I was able to find just even another thread talking about this. It's that, you know, if you deal that final blow, it can have severe repercussions if even one AI player takes this position towards you, the warmonger menace, for they may not be a threat individually, but others are likely to follow, leading to a denunciation. If they fear you're a warmongering menace, then they denunciate, and then like a deck of cards or a domino effect, other civs, when another civ seems to suggest that perhaps you should be denounced, they agree, and then they denounce, and then another player sees that two of them have denounced, and they follow suit. And so now it becomes a question of, if you are a warmongering menace, are they viewing that as kind of a minor or a major thing, and what are they going to do about it? So, as another means, and I emphasize that this is another means because it is not the only way, and I wouldn't even necessarily argue it is the best way, but if you're looking for another way to try to minimize that effect, here's what you do. It requires change, and it's still kind of put in the Civ Fanatics thread in response. Yes, it is changing the game mechanics, but it's using one of Civ's base options, Civ 5 base options, so it's no mods required. You go to the Advanced Setup window, and under Advanced Game Options, you check the Complete Kills button. As it's described, in order to be eliminated from the game, a player must have all his cities and units destroyed. That "and units" is important. So you're engaged in war mid-game, you find a unit of your AI combatant, and you purposely don't destroy it. Ideally, not a zone. And if the unit is in danger of being killed by another player, you can even take reasonable steps if you want to isolate or protect it, if you want to go to that extreme, but it's not necessary, because you wouldn't be dealing the final blow here. You take out the AI combatant's last city. You keep it, you raise it, it becomes part of it, you annex it, whatever it is you decide to do, you take it. Though the AI has no more cities, they have not been eliminated from the game thanks to their surviving unit or units. It can be difficult to find a unit to save, so I don't necessarily go out of my way to find it, but if you're fighting them, you can probably find a unit that you just decide, you know, before I take this city, I'm not going to kill it. I'm going to leave that one alone. And I also speculated that I hadn't tested it with city-state specifically, but I expected it would be the same. But my focus was not on dealing with the eliminating city-state, but rather dealing with a quote-unquote proper AI.
Yeah, the only reason I expressed a little bit of hesitation with this is I'm reminded of some of the abuses you could take in Civ 4 with cooking certain settings. I think one of my favorite examples is in Hall of Fame, you're allowed to check permanent alliances. Again, no mods, same in-game setting, and this is going to be a much more extreme version of your suggestion here with requiring complete kills, Dan, but just to emphasize, you can play on D&D. You could be totally under D&D level. You could actually suck relatively badly at the game, but if you check permanent alliances and manage to say Oracle Metal Casting and bribe someone like Shaka or Montezuma or anyone who's willing to accept war bribes into war, you can generally just win. This is what happens is, you now take your 3, 4, maybe 5 or 6 cities, if you've been good enough to get that many on D&D, and switch them all to producing warriors, and rally them all into the AI territory of your future permanent ally, and just go, here, have a warrior, have a warrior. And you can build warriors pretty late into the game if you trade away all your medals. And because D&D bonuses allow the AI so much gold, and because they get such a huge discount on upgrades, the AI can instantly turn those warriors into whatever the most advanced unit of that era is, and use that to basically just curb stomp everybody, just on sheer numbers. And it's so inexpensive for that AI to do that. And then, of course, you have all that shared war, so you get 40 turns of shared war, they probably like you because of shared war. Permanent ally, boom, domination. Like, 1600s or 1700s AD domination on deity, just by changing one little setting at the game start. Now, this is a much less extreme version of that, but it is certainly a non-standard setting, and you do need to look at the implications of it. I think this is a much more benign thing to take advantage of, and you know, a lot of people can look at it as circumventing a mechanic that's kind of stupid anyway, and the warmongering menace to the world, how that works. So it's not nearly so bad, but that was, I guess, the point of my hesitation is that you can make games extremely easy by cooking settings certain ways or picking certain leaders, etc.
If I was to start this thread today, if I was to do it again, and I didn't do this in part because of how some forums generate threads where thread addresses are actually related to the title, I actually do think I'm a little misleading in the title, and I clarify it in the post. You're not so much... I mean, you are avoiding the warmongering label, but not as an absolute. You're not avoiding it as in you will never get this label if you always follow this and you're actually able to execute it. In other words, yes, I took the AI's last city and they had another unit somewhere, even though I couldn't find one. It's just a means to less likely get it to either warmongering status and to be like a major label in terms of the diplomatic impact. So it's not like an absolute. But as I said, it's towards another way to, yeah, I think a big impetus behind this is the warmongering label menace in and of itself. If that concern about that you're going to get that, if you're the last person to take out the Sith, even if you have been declared on, and we've talked about this before, in kind of the extreme, really seriously category, that they declared war on you, and then you take them out, which I guess some could argue you're not so much defending yourself, you know, you've kind of gone above and beyond that, but still you get that warmongering label menace. This way, it just helps to minimize the impact. And I don't even know how I came across this. I think it was just, I was looking at the game settings, and it was actually that description when I was setting up the game that got me thinking, oh, as we talked before about, you know, don't take that last city or leave that, you know, leave that junker city. You know, preferably not the capital. Because you know, I like to be able to take their capital. I just as a funny aside that I put in the opening post as well, what can be humorous about this also is that depending upon the AI's disposition towards you, you would then think, well, you're going to be able to get peace with this Civ, and if for some reason they had a fair bit of gold in their treasury, that's the other interesting thing. You take out their last city, they still have their gold, and they may still actually be making gold per turn. Well, at least that turn, but they will keep their treasury for turn after turn after turn if they don't spend it. So, I mean, they can have, like, hundreds of gold pieces, and that's pretty impressive for a unit to be carrying around. But okay. This game is about realism, I know.
That unit can sign research agreements, too.
Yes.
Brian denounced you.
They can, so you do have to take into account, maybe I should just get rid of them, because if they denounce me further, then that's, you know, the bigger guy is actually going to get me, so... It's another means. It's very circumstantial, but the best part, if you can actually get them to peace, because they won't necessarily peace that turn, next turn, or even 50 turns later, they may still never get peace with you. But my favorite part about this is if you can get peace, one of the options that's still available in terms of an agreement is open borders. That just brought a smile to my face.
and walk through their unit. I do see a way this can backfire against a player AI like Alex. If you go ahead, he's going for the diplomacy victory, you don't have enough money to bribe the city-states over, you can try and go conquer the city-states, and the city-state has a random caravel exploring the ocean, and you didn't kill the city-state off, so it still votes for Alex, and you lose.
Yeah, that would suck.
Those five guys on a boat sitting off your coast say, no, screw you.
I think the denunciations are probably the worst. That the one unit left alive denounces you, and now you're starting a problem. So I guess you could just get somebody else to kill off their final unit, though, which is probably pretty doable. Or maybe get your city-state to do it.
I found that at least half the time, within... I'm playing with quick speed here, but like within 50 turns or so, that civ will be gone. You're not going to see like a game notification that the civ is gone. I don't think you do. I think it's just, you know, you get the notification that they've lost the city, and then, of course, the game is built that, okay, that's the last city now that civilization's been destroyed. If it does come up on the screen, I've never noticed it. I just go back to diplomacy, thinking maybe, I wonder if they've got some gold that I didn't get before, or will they get peace with me now? And I see that they're not on the diplomacy list anymore, so someone finally did finish the job. Whether it was an AI proper, or a city state, or I suppose if you're a multiplayer with other humans, maybe they finished the task, ultimately dealt that error, quote-unquote, final blow. And come on, let's talk about a little bit of a giggle factor here, because I know that influences some people. There's just nothing like, you know, seeing a civ that's been destroyed, but they're just wandering around still with, like, a worker.
That is kind of cool.
See, if a barb snatches up that worker, can you go kill the barb and return the worker?
Maybe. You can definitely bring this back to life.
I would expect so, yes. If you still had barbs at that point in the game that could spawn, and then it actually did that. I've never seen that, but that's always possible. I like lists. People probably didn't know this. I like sharing.
We learn something new about you every week.
What's your number one civ, Dan?
Well, you know, it's interesting you asked that, Man of Doom, because that actually ties into our next topic.
Oh, no.
I set you up. No, not really. It sounded good. Which is your Civ 5 traits. I hope I'm not cutting anybody off from the previous topic. If so, too bad. No, I'm moving back.
Who's a despot?
Dan's a despot.
I prefer dictator. Thank you, Kelly. You know, here, come on. Oh, get it right. Thread started by Haig. This has been done at least for Civ 4, and I love to read these, and I forget what episode it was. I know that's unlikely not to go look this up, but I know we did discuss this thread earlier, and if you can find the thread, give yourself an imaginary cookie, because they're delicious. But he wants to know what your favorite Civ 5 traits are. And he's broken it down by favorite civ, unit, building, wonder, your AI best friend, your AI worst enemy, not assuming how random personalities, I'm sure. You know that's a favorite of mine. Strengths, weaknesses, that's your strengths and your weaknesses, to clarify, as well as your favorite era in the game. And I will answer, since you asked me what my favorite civ is, Man of War, and... It's hard to say if this is going to stand the test of time, because it is a recent DLC. In fact, most recent DLC. My favorite civ right now is Korea. But, of course, that could just be because it's new and shiny. I would say before that, my favorite civ was probably Spain.
Yeah. Spain's pretty fun.
Just because of its, you know, abuse, which we established, you know, that I like. Why is this a recurring theme in this episode? I'm disturbed. Anyway.
That's no idea. Like, my total innocence.
To make it more interesting, why don't we just go around the table? Well, I mean, we don't have a table, but, you know, pretend we do. And, okay, so my favorite civ is Korea right now in Civ 5. What about everybody else?
Inca.
America, because I like cherry tapping.
To the Inca, they get those movement bonuses, and you can settle your cities as far as you want because trade routes cost nothing, practically. Slingers are fun to screw around with, and then the Terrace Farm is probably one of my favorite and neat stuff in the game, allowing you to settle where other civs can't at all.
Yeah, then if you got hills beside a...
mountains, they become really powerful.
And the maintenance cost is eliminated on hills, right? And
half cost everywhere else, so practically free. And when you get to railroad, you can put railroads on every single hill tile if you want.
The fact that it's half cost for everything else even makes it even desirable, even if you're not playing on a map that's really hill dominant.
Yep.
It took me a while for that second part of that trait to register. And yes, slingers are nice too early on, but I think it's really in their case the unique bonus, and then also their unique
improvement.
Yeah, which not many civs have.
Only Polynesia and Inca.
Right, because Polynesia, they have the Maui statue, right?
Yep.
So that's one for Korea, one for Inca, one for America, because Phil likes to troll conversations.
What are you talking about? That's the legitimate reason to like using a civilization.
Songhai is fun for stomping things.
Not as much as they used to be.
Yeah, I know, but I still have an affection from early on for them. Kind of like how I still like England's murder bows.
Ooh, those murder bows. Murder bows plus Great Wall. Try getting past that.
No point. Just wait. Wait for
an accelerated network.
Well, nukes are always good. Never again. Nukes are the greatest.
I think that's going to be Phil's favorite unit.
I was thinking about saying in Keshek, but I can't in good conscience. It wouldn't be truthful.
I don't have a favorite yet, because there's no pretty colors that I like the most. I think my last game, I was Siam, and I was going around collecting city-states. Is that what?
Oh. Well, if you like Siam's color, is that what you're saying?
No, that's just who I was last time. But, I mean, I keep going around doing random, because I can't figure out who I like the most yet.
Think if you were not a Melanese fan in Civ 4, were you?
Ugly colors.
No. I like India in 4, brown. But they changed their color in 5.
Yes.
They changed it to their real-life coloring, basically.
Oh.
What? No, I mean their flag. Sorry. Jeez. We're actually green and orange in real life.
Oh, I thought we were still talking about Siam.
In India.
It's controversy.
Oh, man.
Oh, God. That is totally not what I meant. I meant an orange like their flag. I was not talking about science.
Coming this Christmas, Civilization 5, the coloring book.
Do you think it's color outside the lines or will the book crash?
So we're on to units.
Yes. Now, I don't think we talked about our favorite unit in general, but it could be a unique unit. Actually, in my case, it is my favorite unit is a unique unit. That's China's Chokonu. Fire it twice in one turn. Oh, yes, please.
More like the choke's on you.
But I'm very good.
I'll take the Ottoman Janissary any day of the week.
Duke comma Keshek.
Anything that has high mobility, but I have another soft spot other than the murder bows for the giant death robots. Powerful snakes, but they're fun. It's even more fun if you're Japan and you use giant death robots to crush everyone.
Apparently, Mackie likes cherry tapping too.
I'll nuke your giant death robots and see how effective they are.
I know, that's what I'm saying. I know they're not super effective, but they're fun. Favoriteness is not always reliant on usability.
Attack and withdraw your giant death robots.
That sounds dirty somehow.
I do like having insta-heals every time I kill stuff.
Yes.
Yes.
It's a super version of the Jaguar.
And then they get that 25% attacking bonus, so they win a lot.
Yeah. They make up for what's otherwise not such a good civ.
I think it's just Kelly that hasn't told us her favorite Civ 5 unit.
I just like all the cute ones.
Favorite building in Civ 5?
Hmm.
Favorite city improvement?
Things that improve my production rate. Good God.
Yeah.
It's pretty much that whole category.
I'll take the granary. It's cheap, and you can work another hill with it, or you can produce more science by having more pop.
I'll do a partial cop-out in the sense that I'm going to actually choose a unique building. I'll take China's paper maker.
I would have said Russia's Crep Post, but it got nerfed.
Oh, yeah, that used to be great with the culture.
My favorite wonder that only one Sith can build per game.
I like the Five Swordsmen wonder.
Who is surprised?
Well, I've played with Phil too long and learned from him that, yeah, the multiple early units to crush somebody wonder is the best.
A troll a sigh. Favorite wonder.
Seriously. Yeah, that's not a troll.
Brandenburg Gate.
Post buff, right?
Post patch, definitely. You give scientist points, so that's always a plus. But the plus 15 experience, you stack that with the other three buildings, and you can get, you know, infantry that have 65% bonus in rough terrain, plus the 25 for rough terrain. That's quite strong.
How about Porcelain Tower these days?
That's just not even funny how strong that one is. They need to overhaul research agreements again.
Again, yes.
It's a favorite, but not my favorite. Part of my choosing, my favorite wonder is, I wouldn't choose Brandenburg Gate only because of the era that it comes in. Now, it's not, I mean, it's a darn good wonder. If I was doing like a later start, I'd probably rank it higher. And even when I choose my favorite wonder, one of my favorite wonders I never build, so I don't consider it a favorite wonder. And actually, Bam Bam notes in the chat, and he talks about the Great Library, but the AI beats me to that almost always, so I'm not going to choose that one. I'm actually going to choose the Hagia Sophia, because then I can, with the plus 25% generation of great people in all cities, really pushing the specialist, and then I get a free great person of my choice, which I then like to build a great engineer with, and then I can turn around and get another wonder and say maybe Porcelain Tower, maybe Notre Dame, maybe Forbidden Palace.
Yeah, build a cheaper wonder to build a more expensive wonder. Are we still talking about abuse here?
Always.
When are we not?
Always. All right, who else hasn't said favorite?
Harold.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Harold's so shiny. It's true, though.
I'm sorry to have infected you with the shiny, but
I'm usually too busy stomping on things lately to stop and build wonders. I haven't really done a cultural game since early on, and all the wonders are different now.
Okay, so view it this way. What wonder would you most like to capture that somebody else built? There you go.
Well, I like taking things like Imagine Castle away from the AI, because, yeah, you don't need that with the extra defense, thanks.
The Great Wall out there, huh?
And I'll say Stonehenge because I'm not a stomper.
Good wonder.
You know, I actually kind of like the Opera House, Sydney Opera House, just because it's something that's more modern and yet it's considered a wonder. So there's not a lot of things that are modern. It's all mostly ancient or even 1700s, 1800s-ish. So.
Well, and I do love opera.
And it's also pretty.
You're liking opera, Kelly. You're forgiven.
That's why I'm tired today. I was up too late last night listening to opera.
That's for another podcast, I think. how about your AI best friend? Let's do the smart answer. My favorite AI best friend is the one that's dead. Now let's be serious.
I like Kel Torak's answer, which was there's no real friends at Civ 5.
It's true.
Yeah.
Because it depends on the
whoever
game.
Whoever happens to be benefiting.
Yeah. This game it's this person. Sometimes, hey, in this game it's Monty, and in this game it's somebody else, and I'm fighting Monty. No, there's no best. There is no AI best friend.
Who's the most gullible and manipulatable?
Probably Alex, because we'll go to war with anyone.
There you go. That's my favorite. Person who's most easily manipulated.
If you can find Wu early enough for her often penance to build a great library and, of course, to get her Chocanoose, because she likes to do a one-city challenge.
I know. It's ridiculous. She'll be on a continent by herself and it's still only one city. What is wrong with you? Are you trying to lose this game? Because this is my army.
She uses to go to war with the person who builds a city minimum distance from her capital. That's annoying.
It's one of those implosion AIs that doesn't play the game. It just kingmates. It throws the game away at random. Yeah, it's real fun.
If you try to attack it, you're in for some trouble.
Yes.
Worst enemy. Well,
Egypt. They don't fight you.
Oh, I was going to say Alex.
They don't fight you, but they will be pissy at you for the whole game.
denounced, denounced.
They just wonder whore and then denounce you. Makes no sense.
Alex gets too close to city-states, not that I necessarily want them myself, but unnecessary distractions destroying him.
Yeah, that can be annoying if you're playing continents and he happens to be the AI on the other continent with 20-plus cities. It gets really hard to do anything.
That's what I was going to say. In a lot of my games, my worst enemy is someone in a distant land that I don't even know who it is, you know, for most of the game, that they're, like, building up, and then I finally meet them, and I'm like, oh, dear.
Yeah, they sold, like, three people, and they have 10 city-states as allies, and you meet them in the state, and you're fighting really well, but what do you do in that case? There's no one left alive to sign research agreements, or you know, they might not last very long.
Strengths and weaknesses in Civ 5. Well, weakness, I still play this game.
Weaknesses in Civ 5 multiplayer. Oh, wait, my weaknesses in Civ 5, never mind.
Strengths, I would say for myself, wide empire building and diplomacy, weaknesses, research agreement maximization, and optimizing city-state use. So no, I just don't turn city-states off. It's tempting sometimes, I do try.
I always find the naval combat fun if you're against a human. I tend to end up on top of those when I do play multiplayer.
Competitively.
Not the, for fun, to try and stomp people.
Wait a minute, that can be fun.
True. Stomping someone.
What about, favorite era too? Boy, that's a tough one. As much of a slugfest as it can potentially be, I'm gonna say medieval, with classical a close second.
Say ancient and classical, because the beginning of the game is probably the most vital.
Yeah, I'll go with classical.
I want to say my weakness, because it'll make Phil cry, is that I wait until I'm way too ready before I declare war, and Phil would just cry to watch me play. So he'd be like, oh my god, you should go to war like a million years before you actually do.
Well, it's better not to have a failed offense.
That's true. You want it to succeed. Although in Civ 5, you can generally keep your units alive, unless you just wander in to death, I guess. Well, against AI. Like, AI has no tactical sense.
When the AI gets fighters, it's a bit tougher.
Yeah, I suppose. Nukes.
I'm just really pathetic.
Your fighters are in one city? Bye-bye.
Yeah. Problem solved. No, I'm definitely strong in military, and because they keep releasing new versions of the beta, I'm having trouble keeping up with some of the economy side of the game, but I'm learning there. And I would say that's probably my weaker side, is when it comes to, like, picking the right micromanagement choices for setting up in the early game. That's something that I would like to work on next in terms of getting better at the Civ 5.
One of our listeners in the chat has chimed in. His favorite Civ, China, favorite unit, Chokwanu, favorite building, paper maker. That's what it had their bandmen. Favorite Wonder, great library. AI best friend, Napoleon. Really?
Always attacks me with musketeers. Annoying.
And he put the AI worst enemy because he wanted to hear one of us try to pronounce it. Thanks. I'm just going to say it's Rami. I'm going to cheat.
Ram Homecoming or Ramses?
No, the Siam. Rami.
Siam.
The Siamese are very annoying in Civ 5. They're up there among the more annoying.
Offense.
Strengths, tactical combat, weaknesses over expansion, favorite era, industrial. Really?
Can be. When you get all the fighters and, well, bombers are modern, but industrial naval battles are fun because you get subs and battleships and destroyers, fighters.
You actually get some decent units to make it
interesting. Whereas Renaissance, whoever has more frigates wins.
And takes us to a topic that is a particular near and dear to the hearts of Mackie and Kelly.
They trademarked Alpha Centauri. They trademarked Alpha Centauri. What are they doing with it? What are they doing with it? What are they doing with it?
Mackie, here's some deep app. Continue.
Dan, you don't know how important this is.
That's right. It's very important. They finally realized they actually had something useful on their hands. They might actually do something with it now. Or let it sit for another 10 years till the trademark expires again. I don't know which. Because they trademarked some other things more recently, like Syndicate and Wing Commander, and they still haven't done anything with those. So, who the hell
knows? No way. Did they really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Those games were awesome. What the hell?
Especially Wing Commander. Modern Wing Commander. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. That would be great.
Yes.
I like Syndicate a lot, too. That was a lot of fun. It got really hard, but I didn't care. That game was awesome.
As far as Syndicate goes, EA announced a partnership with a company called Starbreeze to reinvent this particular title, and they filed a trademark for it. This was in 2008 they announced this, and they got the trademark for it last year. So perhaps something is actually afoot with Alpha Centauri and others.
Dun, 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 dun.
Oh, no, stop humming Wing Commander music. Stop humming Wing Commander music. I can't believe that's still in my head like 15, 20 years later almost. Has it been? Yeah, it is about that long.
I played so much Wing Commander 3. You quit the game. It's like, while you sleep, they'll be waiting.
This is a good sign. Let's just hope they know they don't pull an XCOM because.
Dan, why did you put that idea into the atmosphere?
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Abuses!
We all love abuse.
Abuse, like, yeah.
Ghosts.
I did win Domination, one of my first games that way. Or Battleships. Bye-bye.
Aw, you suck my vouch.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, that had to be said. That had to be said. Showing my age, I know.
I think that's the game still around. Maybe not.
It is.
Yeah, they're making a movie.
True.
You suck my Battleship movie?
Yeah, there's a movie of that. How lame is that?
They're making everything into movies now.
Gosh.
No, we don't know either. It's just, what? You do Battleship? What? You know?
How does that even have a plot?
I know, you would expect me to be joking, but I'm not.
No.
Now, Man of Doom, there are certain films that don't have a plot and they do quite well, so maybe this...
Those also involve mass quantities of nakedness.
Mackie, have you ever seen a battleship with clothes?
It's a full frontal assault of abuse.
Oh. Full frontal, oh dear. I do believe we have now come to the end of the show.
It's also come to the end of my cup of coffee.
Kelly?
Oh, I was supposed to say goodbye to
them. No, for the people.
Kelly wants the show to go for another couple hours.
Yeah, because I like abuse too. This was 1:28.
No, you messed that up again.
Yeah. And we had a good time abusing Dank. And we were, who was here? Phil was here.
Speaking of abuse, mine worms.
In fact, he was here.
Speaking of abuse, play the university. Holy crap.
And the Man of Doom was here.
Yeah, yawn.
Aw, I think we've
poisoned. Oh, ouch. I think we just got burned.
Dan was here on Much Abuse.
Which is why he likes it, apparently.
Colonize this.
And I was here on K-Mac Candy.
Pig iron, say it. I made a reference to it earlier and you didn't say a word. I was disappointed.
I didn't hear it.
I was talking about the city growth caps and like you made I have a 6-year-old tie like corn or pig and iron.
Aww,
so depressing.
Sorry.
You can do better. Sorry.
Sorry.
No, say it. No, that's not good enough to say you're sorry.
What am I supposed to say?
I don't know where Dan is going with this.
For Pig Iron Diddy. You don't remember? Oh, dear.
What? I'm supposed to call it Leonard Nimoy?
This is awkward. No. Pig Iron. I got all Pig Iron.
You know,
sorry. You didn't say that. It's not good. I'm sick.
That's why I told my husband
that I got Obsidian out of them.
Record date September 3rd, 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.